Jeff Epps is the greatest player that's ever played in Florida.
This Nugget's pink, and I hate it.
About to go hard for 50 minutes.
You can't say stuff like this on podcast, all right?
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Monday, November 2nd, 2009. I'm your host, Adam Berry. Joining me today, two football writers who know that the real best football team in Florida played in Tropicana Field this weekend. We got Kyle Maestri.
Go Tuskers.
And Mike McCall.
Yeah, whatever.
We got a lot to talk about on today's show. We're going to recap the Florida-Georgia game from this weekend, talk about what moved in the college football polls and some of the undefeated teams still remaining. And we're also going to break out and preview the men's basketball team season a little bit. They kick off their exhibition season tonight. I'll be covering that game. We're going to wrap up with our Reggies and Kyles and most likely some Florida Tuskers talk. So all you Tuskers loyal, just hang in for that. But let's start off with the Florida-Georgia recap. Kyle, just give general impressions from that.
Well, before the game on Friday, I wrote a column about how this game wouldn't be worth remembering. It would be pretty boring, so everyone should just go out and get hammered. Which I'm usually against. And as usual, I was 100% wrong. It was a good game for Florida fans. It wasn't all that close, so I've been wronger. But if you were a Florida fan, this is definitely a game that was obviously exciting to watch. There were a ton of really big plays. The 41-17 score was probably a little bit, I don't want to say misleading, because it was good through the first half, but Florida really just dominated the second half. It was a joke. They got four interceptions. Brandon Spikes took one back to the house to end the game, and it was just pretty much domination by the defense in the second half and a good first half by the offense, which is something that we haven't seen. They protected the ball, no turnovers. Yeah. Tim Tebow looked the best he's looked all season by far. He broke Herschel Walker's rushing record in front of all the Georgia fans, so definitely a good game for Gators fans.
Was it anything different with the offense, or was it just Georgia being bad, a combination of the two?
Georgia's bad on defense, so that helps. But, yeah, no, they came out absolutely throwing the ball for the first time all season, and it really worked for them. I mean, they went right down the field. They didn't even pick up a third down on the first drive. They just went right down the field, throwing the ball with short passes, moving it quickly. The ball came out of Tebow's hands on time, three steps, or I guess not a three-step drop because he's in the shotgun, but like he just caught it, threw it on time, back foot down, balls out, and it was nice to watch. It was completely different than what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, they looked a lot better. The biggest difference was Tebow. I mean, he played like himself, played a good game. Didn't really even throw that many passes, and he was really effective. So that's kind of what you're used to seeing out of Tebow. That's the kind of game you want to see where they just kind of turn it over to the running game and the defense. You know, Tebow gets his damage done early. Riley Cooper had a great game. That one-handed catch in the back of the end zone was incredible.
Sick catch.
Yeah, really positive day overall. And another thing that I was kind of paying attention to on Saturday, they've been running like mostly vertical routes with their receivers and not bringing that many people across the field, which I think it was stupid. I don't really know why. I mean, it makes it harder for Tebow to find people. And when he scrambles, it makes it harder for him to find people open. Mm-hmm. And it looks like they did a better job of being more creative with that on Saturday. Mm-hmm. So in every phase was a step in the right direction.
Yeah, they even got more receivers involved this time. It wasn't Cooper and Hernandez. Even David Nelson caught a pass or two.
His first four passes went to different receivers. Yeah. And I believe the breakdown was like four catches to Cooper and then three each to like Hernandez, David Nelson, and Deontay Thompson. So really spread the ball around well. That's exactly what you want to see.
So the exact kind of balance we were asking for, the whole, you know, complaining about that they didn't have going
right
into
this game. And that all came from Tebow, because those guys were open enough to have three catches the last couple games, you know, if they hold on to the ball. I mean, even, you know, that drop Brandon James had that could have been a touchdown, at least would have put them inside the 20.
Yeah.
That was atrocious. I don't understand how you can catch a punt in traffic, but you can't catch a pass. I mean, it wasn't like over his shoulder. Yeah. He wasn't moving. He was standing still. The ball hit him in the chest. He bobbled it and threw it on the ground pretty much. That was awful.
Hit him right in the worst place.
Aaron Hernandez had kind of a surprising drop, too, that would have gone for, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 yards maybe. So, Tebow's stats could have been even better, but he played a really good game. It doesn't really matter. They won big.
Was the difference all mental for him, do you think?
I don't know. Like I said, I've always thought it's kind of like a trust thing where he like locks in. It has a lot to do with how they start the game. If they start the game, run right down the field and score, they weren't taking a long time at the line of scrimmage. They looked decisive. They looked like they knew what they wanted to do, and they were going to do it. It was the first time you've seen them really decide they're going to impose their will on someone with their offense. They've been doing it with, like, you know, time of possession and defense in a lot of the other games, and the offense has been kind of middle, especially the last two games, terrible. But you know, this time they really came out, looked like they knew what they wanted to do on the first drive, and they got it done. And if you start positively with this team and with Tebow, it changes everything dramatically. It also changes the way they coach the game from then on.
Yeah, and the coaches shut it down a little bit once they got up big, which is, that's what you should do. I mean, don't shut it down at the beginning when you're up a touchdown, but, you know, they came out passing, and then eventually they transitioned into protecting the ball, running the ball, which is fine. But they did a good job forcing him to throw the ball to everyone. It wasn't that he was, like, hitting different receivers 10, 15 yards downfield, but they threw some screen passes, they threw some short crossing routes. They did a good job getting everyone involved without having Tebow, making it hard on Tebow to get everyone involved. They made it very easy. And, had there not been a couple drops, I think you would have seen bigger numbers out of him. And he ran the ball effectively, more effectively than he has the last few games. The touchdown run where he broke Herschel Walker's record was absolutely disgusting. It was a 23-yard run. Supposed to go outside. There was nothing there. He cut it back inside, broke a tackle, and was gone. And it was really just he just looked great. He looked like he used, like the old Tebow in this game.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say, too. He looked great on the ground. Looked like himself. Picked up five third down conversions with his legs. I mean, and that's really what you want out of him, is picking up those third downs. And see, every single time he gets that 1 yard more than what he needs on third down. And he was back to that on Saturday. So it was really encouraging. And even with Demps, Moody, Rainey got hurt, but those guys didn't get a whole lot done. They still finished 210 rushing yards, in large part thanks to Mike Gillisley coming on late. Actually finished the team's second leading rusher with 3 carries for 57 yards.
Kind of, kind of broke a big one at the end.
Yeah,
49 yards.
Pulled,
yeah.
Pulled his hamstring or something at the end. Do we expect this to continue in the last half of the schedule? The upcoming games aren't exactly against the toughest of competition, so.
It can go either way. I mean, I don't know. Like, I wouldn't expect to see them revert back to what they did the last couple games because, I mean, they've seen what they changed and how it worked.
Right.
But as far as, like, focus-wise and fumbling and missing tackles, I mean, that could happen against Vanderbilt easily. Mm. I'd expect to see them play really well against South Carolina, I'll tell you that. You know, probably going to be a night game in Columbia against Spurrier, against a good defense. I'd expect to see them play really well in that one, so.
One of the big things I kept track of, too, is I don't have the previous stats to this for the other games, but I kept track of first down plays, runs and passes, and it was almost exactly 50-50. I want to say it was 16-15 runs to passes or 16-14, but obviously they did a little more of that at the end when they were just sitting on the ball. So they did a really good job of coming out balanced there. It wasn't predictable. It wasn't a first down run every single time and then passing it in passing situations. Adazio just did a much better job, and I think if they're smart, which they are, they look at this game and they say, look, we did it. Look how good that looked. We came out, we tried to be balanced, we tried to throw the ball, it worked. We put our guys in situations to succeed. We let them run shorter routes instead of getting downfield. We ran quick hitting plays instead of plays that take forever to develop. I don't see how they don't learn from this. Keep this kind of game plan in place, and then I expect pretty good results going forward after their game like this.
All right, anything else about the offense before we move on here? All right, let's talk about the defense then. Usually when we praise one part of Florida's team, we go on to just bash the other, but this time, good words for both sides. Let's talk about the defense. 4 picks, you mentioned it before. They pretty much had their way with Joe Cox and company.
As predicted by Phil Kegler. it was an interception party out there.
It was a pick party.
a pick party.
As the outrageous Phil Kegler said. What do they have going so well for them there? I mean, they shut down A.J. Green and everything.
Yeah, A.J. Jones made the absolute play of the game. The defense honestly didn't look great in the first half. I mean, they gave up 10 points, which is a lot for them in one half. I know that's not damning exactly, but that's a lot for them, and it was legitimate, down-the-field drives. It wasn't the offense put them in a bad situation.
Yeah.
But in the second half, they're up 2 touchdowns. A.J. Jones gets to the quarterback, Joe Cox, tips the ball up in the air, dives and catches it himself. Giving UF a short field to score, go up by 3 touchdowns. That really, I think, solidified the game, changed the momentum. And from there, he added another interception later. Stamper got a diving interception off a tip ball, and then Spikes walked one in. So it was 4 interceptions by the three linebackers, which is impressive. None of the defensive backs got one. But the whole defense really just played well. They gashed them a little bit on the run at times, but I think you saw that the defense didn't wear down. They got stronger as the game went on because they had a lot more guys healthy than they normally do, and the rotation was going on the defensive line, and everybody just looked like there was no fatigue setting in, as you've seen in the last couple games.
Mm. Yeah, and also A.J. Jones, the pass that he tipped an interception, that's the third time in 4 years that Florida's forced a turnover on Georgia's first drive of the second half, and that's been that momentum turner in pretty much every game where they just run away with it from there. So If they can keep that streak alive, they're not going to lose to Georgia for a while, because that's, you know, that changes the game right out of the gate in the second half when, you know, Georgia's looking to come out and get a little momentum.
Let me guess which year they didn't do it.
Yeah.
2007.
You know, I think it was Ray McDonald fumble recovery in 2006, and Hayden had that pick and long return last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, linebackers played great. They were all over Cox. A.J. Green, 3 catches for 50 yards. That's his worst game of the year. Yeah. Linebackers had more catches than A.J. Green did, which is a good stat. And also special teams looked really good. Chaz Henry had 3 punts. Oh, two of them,
such an NFL leg.
Two of them down inside the 20. He is
inside
not allowed.
Inside the 6.
Really?
Two of them inside the 6. One at the 6, one at the 3.
Yeah. One of his was 61 yards. He hasn't allowed a punt return yard this season.
That's unbelievable to me.
Incredible.
I don't even know what that means, but like, it's incredible.
And then Caleb Sturgis, 100 yards worth of field goals. He had a 56-yarder and a 44-yarder. The 56-yarder was the second longest in school history, which somebody hit a 60-yarder in the 80s. That's outrageous.
84.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Nice. That was good from 60, too, the one he hit. Yeah. Like, he hit a flush and hit the net.
His 51-yarder a couple weeks ago would have been the same.
Yeah, that 56-yarder, that was like an NFL kick, like as far as I could tell. It was very, very impressive.
He's got a big leg. He's not so much on the left to right, but distance, he's got that down.
I think there may have been something about the wind. Either the wind was blowing well for them to that side of the field, or Sturgis and Phillips both have huge, huge legs. Because in pregame, they were kicking from the 30-yard line and kicking it over the net. Over the net. Like, into the stands. I'm just like, is this happening right now? It was so weird to watch, but they were just booming him in pregame, and it get totally carried over into the game when Sturgis hit that 56-yarder.
One last game-specific thing I think it's worth noting, just because it's kind of funny. It's George's little motivational tactic where they went out
and
switched.
Two.
Well, the jerseys is the one I wanted to start with. That was a ridiculous Halloween thing. I don't know.
Yeah, it was pretty lame. I mean, they came out in warm-ups in their normal red helmets, silver pants. The captains even did the coin toss, red helmets, silver pants, and the team ran out behind them in their black pants and black helmets. And then somebody ran out to the captains with black helmets. They switched their helmets, grabbed scissors, and cut their silver pants off of them.
Ooh.
And they had the black ones on under. It was pretty ridiculous. I mean, I guess you could say the same thing about the end zone celebration, because after their first touchdown, the tight end Aaron White, they got together on the sideline and did the same kind of celebration just on their own sideline. I mean, I guess that's all lame when you don't win.
Yeah.
If you win, it's kind of interesting and cool. But I don't know. It's just that shouldn't be what you have to do to get your team ready for a Florida-Georgia game.
That's what I don't understand. It's like, do Georgia players not get up for a game like this? Like, why does Mark Richt have to keep doing things like this to try to get them energized? It's really bizarre to me. I don't understand it.
I said any time they spent thinking, like, even if they spent 1 second, like, hey, let's wear black helmets and black pants, like, that's a second they spent not planning for a game that they desperately needed to prepare for. And any time they spent, like, you know what we need to do after we score this first touchdown? Celebrate on the sideline, like, don't plan that stuff. Like, let it happen naturally.
Tennessee had a weird jersey combo, too.
Worked for them, though.
The black with orange lettering looked very Halloweenish.
I liked it.
Fitting.
I know I'm the only person in the world, but I liked it. I always like black jerseys.
Yeah.
Almost without exception.
Yeah.
So.
All right, the black jersey. The black helmets just, I don't know, threw me off. I went all right with that. But let's talk about some other stuff related to football. You mentioned this Brandon Spikes, Tim Tebow confrontation. I don't know what to call it. Go ahead and explain that.
Yeah, it sounds like a bunch of crap. somebody wrote on like a blog that doesn't really cover the team. That is where this like really started. Wrote about how Brandon Spikes and Tim Tebow had like a confrontation in the locker room after the Mississippi State game, and then it got mentioned in a few game stories and got talked about. Spikes got asked about it and said like there wasn't like a fight or anything. We just talked about it. Like, you know, it was in the locker room when a bunch of people were getting up and speaking about like whose fault it was and what they needed to change and blah, blah, blah. And I guess word got out that during that, Spikes and Tebow kind of got in a heated exchange with one another. And, I mean, we don't really know. We kind of have to take them at their word, but it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Like, and even if they did, it's not like they don't like each other or anything. I mean, you got to remember that, you know, Spikes came here because of Tebow and stayed here because of Tebow because he wanted to play with him. He's not harboring any resentment toward him. So, I mean, they needed it to sort some things out, and whatever they did worked.
Yeah.
Whether they got in a fist fight or whether they just yelled at each other, they should do it more often if they had these kind of problems, because things worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I buy that it happened, but I mean, I don't buy that it's a big deal that it happened. I mean, they're mature enough, they've been playing together long enough where it's probably just good for them to just get it out and then move on. You don't want, like, complete finger point. I mean, I'm sure it never crossed the line to a place it shouldn't have went. You know, like, Brandon Spikes isn't calling for Tim Tebow to be benched and stuff like that. You know, it's not like a situation like that. So, but yeah, I totally buy it because by all accounts, Urban Meyer gave one hell of a fiery speech on the Friday night before the Georgia game.
Yeah.
And, you know, they wouldn't tell us what it was about, but from everything that we've gathered, it was just about, like, staying together as a team, not letting outside things, you know, divide you guys, you know, play together, you're a family, all that kind of stuff. And there's no way he takes the time to deliver that sort of a message in such an inspirational way from what everybody said if that isn't happening. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's cool for them to say, like, oh, the media just says all this ridiculous crap and, like, we never buy into that and we're just always united. But it's obvious that there was finger-pointing from things that we heard. I mean, Meyer just came right out after the Mississippi State game and started talking about that kind of stuff without us even asking any questions, just in his first address to us.
Yeah.
So it was clearly going on, and I'm not surprised that it was going on because the offense was pathetic up to that point in the season. But, you know, I don't think it's a bad thing for them, and I think this might be what they need to go forward. I'm sure the mood is great now, and they can all go on and just win another national championship.
And you had Billy Donovan in to do another motivational speech, right?
Yep.
That's how you know he's...
Brought in reinforcements, yeah, Billy D.
That's how you know he needs to, you know, bring the team together. You bring in Billy after...
See, that was a year early. I thought you'd bring in Billy for how to never move on from losing a graduating class that carried you for a couple of years there. So maybe they'll get that speech next year.
He's waiting in the wings. He'll come back at some point. Once a year, I feel like he has to roll Billy out for an extremely motivating speech. Let's also talk about another thing related to Brandon Spikes, the ever-popular eye-gouging incident. It's now all over the internet. Who was it that he reached into the running back's helmet?
Yeah, it was Washaun Ely. He's sporting Knowshon Moreno's 24.
Yeah.
And it was the drive where Georgia scored their last touchdown to get 17 points. They were down near the goal line. Ely went up the middle, got kind of gang-tackled, and Spikes, you can see it pretty clearly on YouTube, like reaching inside his face mask, trying to gouge his eyes out. So, and actually, if you watch, there's a longer clip on YouTube that shows like the half of that drive, and the play before that, him and Ely kind of got into it after the play, and like three or four plays before that, they were also like bumping each other and had to be separated by the ref. So this was kind of like a long-running thing between them. And also, if you remember early in the game, when Spikes came off the field, took his helmet off and was like holding his eyes. So I don't know if the same thing happened to him or what. I never saw a replay of it.
All right, so like, there's no punishment for this that we know of right now.
He's suspended for the first half against Vanderbilt.
He is suspended for the first
Urban
half.
Urban Meyer said that this morning at his press conference.
Was that Urban did that or somebody Urban, that was from above?
Yeah, okay. Urban, yeah. So that's pretty much to prevent the SEC from taking any action because they might have if Florida didn't do anything. And the SEC doesn't suspend you for a half. They'll take you out for a game.
Yeah.
And not that it really matters. I don't know if they really need Brandon Spikes for Vanderbilt. But, you know, it's good that they did this because, I mean, what he did was bad and wrong. And I know this stuff happens in football. I know that, Bill Romanowski used to just grab people's fingers and twist them until they broke. And sometimes they were his teammates' hands he couldn't see. I know that stuff happens in football. But if you do it and it's caught on camera, you should certainly be punished for it. Because that kind of stuff needs to be deterred as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he definitely should have been punished for it. So it's good that he was. But I definitely don't buy this being a big deal.
No.
You know, I mean, this is honestly, Bobby played football for a long, long time, and he was saying that far worse stuff than that happens at the bottom of piles, which I don't really want to know. But it's just something that happens, and he was stupid enough to get caught, and so he will be punished, and we can all move on.
Here's my big problem with it, is that you're up by a ton of points against Georgia, and you're Brandon Spikes.
Yeah.
There's no reason for you to get into that. Like, this isn't like a hotly contested rivalry game, like at night, where it's really close and there's a lot on the line. You're blowing out Georgia. The game's pretty much over. Why? Like, why do it then? You're just letting your emotions get the better of you by way too much. And that's why I have a much bigger problem with this particular incident than one in that other situation that I described, because this is just totally unnecessary and stupid. It's always unnecessary and stupid,
but
in this case, even more so.
It's inexcusable at this point.
Right.
And the one other thing, I guess, looking forward, Florida clinched the spot in the SEC title game, which, of course, was their goal all year, as we know very well. Yeah, they just wanted to get to Atlanta.
Here comes the dangerous part.
They popped champagne in the locker room after the game. I hear people were jumping around. The goggles came out.
Meyer didn't want to make an undefeated season their goal, because if they lost, they'd lose motivation.
Yeah.
No, they've already achieved their goal, so they've got nothing to play for. Yeah.
Everything's a trap game from here on out.
Yeah, so now you're going to start to see their real team attitude, which you kind of saw when the season started anyway. The players talk about being undefeated all the time and how that's all that matters. So
they're going to go 0-4 down the stretch, including a miserable loss to FIU at home, as there's nothing left to play for, and then rally back and win in Atlanta, because that's all that matters. That's all I think about.
Yeah, that's all that matters to them.
He just got an email from the SEC. They've announced the start time for Florida-South Carolina. It's going to be the CBS main game, 3:30.
Yes.
So, good for our deadlines.
Yep. And Vanderbilt to what, 7:15?
7:15, yeah.
Is that ESPN?
Bad ESPN 2? ESPN 2 for the Vanderbilt game. And CBS, main game, South Carolina. And if you're going to South Carolina, make sure you hit up the Bojangles across the street from Williams-Brice Stadium. It's one of the best located Bojangles in the southeastern United States.
I assume we'll be doing that.
Absolutely.
Several times, probably.
Second year in a row, the Vanderbilt game's on the Deuce.
On the Deuce, yeah. That's what happens when you play Vandy. Doesn't matter what you're ranked in the country. If you're playing Vandy, the best you can do is the Deuce.
I like the Deuce. I don't know. It's I think
it's fun. I don't know.
I'd still rather watch a game on the Deuce than a network, I think.
Well, any reason in particular?
I don't know. I like ESPN's coverage better. I'm going to sell out to the Goliath that is ESPN.
The man.
Yeah.
I like the whole, when I'm watching SEC football, I like the whole like CBS logo and the feel and the music. I don't know. That does it for me. That's what I associate with. I associate SEC football still with CBS and like Raycom
Jefferson Pilot.
Yeah. So ESPN's still like a latecomer for me for the SEC.
Mm. All right, and after the win, Florida maintained the number one spot in both polls by a sizable margin. You want to just talk about that and what happened in the polls this week?
Yeah, the number one in the BCS and the AP. In the AP poll, they got 38 first place votes. Texas got 13. Alabama got 8. So what, did Alabama drop to third by having a bye week? That's cool. And then the BCS, it's BCS top 5. Florida, Texas, Alabama, Iowa, Cincinnati. AP voters much less high on Iowa than the computers are. It's
correct.
Florida, Texas, Alabama, Cincinnati, Boise State, and then Iowa drops from fourth. Iowa drops from fourth to eighth when you go from the BCS to the AP poll. So that's pretty wild. Still same situation pretty much. Florida, I mean, USC is out of the picture now after losing to Oregon. So it's pretty much Florida and Alabama control their own destiny. They just can't lose twice. Pretty much the same thing with Texas, and then Cincinnati, Boise, and TCU are all knocking on the door, and so is Iowa.
Did anyone catch the Ducks game this weekend?
I caught either part of it, yeah.
Oh, it was so glorious. I've never felt better about watching a game. I did watching the end of that game in Gators Dockside, a few miles outside of Jacksonville. It was tremendous.
I was very upset. I really wanted to see Florida, USC, and Pasadena. I thought that would be
That would have been cool, yeah.
So,
but you can still hold out hope for Florida-Boise State, which is the game everybody should be hoping for.
I don't want to see a bad game.
It's a recession-proof title
it
game.
It is.
You hate America if you don't want to see that game.
Clearly. You hate the economy.
I'd love to see it
you hate capitalism.
One that I'm not going to be at. Like, I want the game I'm at to be like epic and awesome.
It
will be.
It's history.
No, Boise State's going to lose by 40 and then never have a chance.
This will be a documentary someday.
If Boise, TCU, Cincinnati, if one of those teams makes it this year, it's the end of like the little guy's hopes in the BCS because they're going
to
get.
But doesn't that need to happen at some point?
No, why is it guaranteed they'll lose by 40? They've proven that they can play against good teams and win.
Yeah, but they haven't ever been on a stage like this. Oklahoma doesn't give a crap about the Fiesta Bowl when their goal of winning the national championship is gone. When you have Florida in a national championship game with a month to prepare for Boise State, sure, it'll be kind of cool, and I hope they pull out a lot of gimmicky stuff to try and stay in the game. They don't have the athletes. They don't have the talent.
Right,
they're not going to match up with
you
Florida.
You can say this. Okay, first of all, you can say the same thing about the Big Ten,
yeah,
and I would
Iowa
be more in agreement with you. Or a number of other schools.
I don't want to see Iowa play either.
Okay.
I'm not saying Florida, USC, Texas, Alabama.
Those four, pick me two.
I think Florida is going to play. Why USC? Look, Oregon lost to Boise State. Oregon beat USC. Boise State's definitively better than USC.
USC,
property.
Better athletes. Give them a month to prepare for a game that really matters, and they're playing at home. I mean, come on. USC.
No, USC is not good this year. Oregon's better than USC.
They have better
year.
Athletes, better talent.
Apparently they do. On offense, they do. Their offense is unstoppable right now. They hung 600 yards. 611 yards on that USC defense that's so good. How good's your defense if you go up 611 yards and you're starting a freshman quarterback on offense? USC is traditionally very good, but not this year. But we got way too far from the point. Boise State's going to be the national championship game.
I would like to see Pete Carroll versus Urban Meyer.
Yeah,
that would
be awesome.
Fun.
And that would be the changing of the guard in college football if Meyer beats Pete Carroll. It would have been an awesome game, and I think it would have been really epic.
I mean, it would be awesome if USC was better, but they're not.
I agree.
I think with a month to prepare for one team and all the athletes at USC, you're forgetting the people that they have there, the talent that they have there. They don't play well together, just like Florida didn't play well together up until last week. It's the same problem with USC. Plus, they traditionally underachieve against bad teams in the Pac-10. It's the same thing you always see. They still have great athletes, and if you give them that long to prepare for one team with their coaching staff and all of those athletes, you get a good game.
Say athletes one more time! This is their 2007, though. Even
talent.
When Florida was bad in 2007, they had all the same athletes. It was all the same players. They had the athletes. But you got to come in. You got to adjust. You got to fill in your new role as starters. They lost all three of their linebackers last season. They lost
so
much talent off that team. They lost a number one quarterback off that team. They lost all kinds of talent, and there's just new people filling into new roles, and they'll be good the next couple of years, but this is their turnover year, and they're not as good as they've been in the last couple of years.
Here's my point. USC has, like, the raw talent that could be amassed into a force to stop Florida or Alabama or Texas.
2 years from now.
Boise State does not have what they need. They don't have the raw potential and the raw talent to organize into beating Florida. It doesn't work. With that much time off, that much time to prepare for one team, it doesn't happen.
I mean, sure, give USC the entire offseason, they'll come back, they'll be better next year.
Well, I mean, it's different when you're playing for the national championship at home. It's obviously different, especially for college kids. I mean, it's a big deal, and USC plays differently in those games than they do in the regular season. You see that every year, pretty much.
Boise State plays up when they need to as well. I mean, you saw.
I don't understand why Boise doesn't get any respect. They beat Oregon 2 years in a row.
I mean, their schedule. You can argue that.
Yeah, that's fine. But they've proven they beat the little guys they're supposed to week in and week out. I mean, there are teams like Michigan who's lost to App State. Iowa almost lost to Northern Iowa earlier this year. There's been like upsets with teams where it shouldn't happen. They lost USC lost to Washington, a team they're much better than. Boise State takes care of business every week against the little guys, and they play up in the big games. I don't understand why they shouldn't get a shot if the situation falls right, which it probably won't for them. But
look, I want a playoff, and I want these teams to have a shot at it. But the game that I might be traveling cross-country to see, I want to see a game that I know has the potential to be really close and really good. And I also don't want to be at the game that kills the little guy's hopes of ever reaching a national championship again.
Just think, what if the little guy wins, though?
Yeah, the little guy.
Then you witness
not,
history.
The little guy's not going to win.
History. You love history. We've been through this. All right, the other thing we want to talk about that is there are, I believe, 7 undefeated teams still left. And this is more than halfway through the season. It's an impressive top-heavy year so far.
Absolutely.
From what I've seen.
Yeah, it's ridiculous there's still 7 undefeated teams, but they are UF, Alabama, Texas, Boise State, Iowa, Cincinnati, and TCU. So there's 7 teams. There's a possibility for 6 to be undefeated because Alabama and Florida would have to play each other in an SEC championship game. So assuming that they go undefeated into the championship game and it yields one team, we'll go UF right now.
Mm-hmm.
Who do we think will be taken into the national championship game? And what order would you put them in as far as the pecking order when teams would fall off?
It'll be Texas.
If Texas goes.
I feel like that's not really up for debate.
Right.
If it's Florida and Texas, if it's Alabama and Texas, that will be it.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I don't really know. I feel like Iowa's going to get love just because they get so much love from the computers. It's disgusting.
Iowa's playing such a dangerous game. I can't even. Like, I almost feel like there's no way they finish undefeated.
I agree.
I'm with you, but yeah, if they do, they have their 2 best games in front of them still. So, not their 2 best games. They play Ohio State still in front of them.
Their 2 toughest games, yeah.
They will have sort of earned it, as much as I don't like the Big Ten. If you run undefeated, you kind of deserve a shot. But the problem is with all the other undefeated teams, like, who really knows? I think you know, Boise State is probably at the bottom of the pecking order. Do we think they're ahead or behind TCU?
They're behind TCU at this point. As much as it kills me to admit it, I think they are behind TCU.
I don't really know.
No comment?
I don't care.
Yeah, it's kind of irrelevant. Like, I want to see them get in a game and beat a big team in some bowl game where the other team doesn't really care, but I don't want to see them play a team that really cares and get crushed.
Would you take Iowa or Cincy?
I don't know. Probably Iowa.
Yeah.
See, I think Iowa plays in a slightly tougher conference, but Cincinnati's been infinitely more impressive to me. I feel like they've just won, look like a really solid team, whereas Iowa seems to be escaping every week. And, like, I know, like, style points don't really matter. There's no margin of victory formula anymore. But Cincy just, like, they look like a team that's really, really good right now. And if they beat Pitt at the end of the year, I believe that's the last game of the season. Me and Phil were looking at this. I'm pretty sure that's the last game of the season for them. And if Pitt wins, they're 1 loss, and since he's no losses heading into that game, that'll be a hell of a game. So I actually think both of those teams are good, despite the Big East not being so good.
I think Cincy is better than Iowa, without a doubt, but I think Iowa gets preferential treatment just because being from the Big Ten.
I think I agree with that.
You guys know how many undefeated teams there were at this point last year?
How many?
8.
Huh.
8?
Even more, but they were really spread out through the polls, and there were...
were they, like, smaller? There were a lot of smaller teams,
schools.
Right?
Texas was 8-0, Alabama was 8-0, they were 1-2, and then Penn State was 3rd at 9-0. Texas Tech all the way down at 7th at 8-0.
Texas Tech was
Utah was 10th at 8-0. Boise was 11th at 7-0. Ball State, 16th at 8-0. Tulsa was 7-0 at 18th, on their way to a heartbreaking loss in the Conference USA Championship to ECU. So, a lot of smaller schools, and, you know, you still had teams there that were going to knock each other out. You had, you know, between Texas and Texas Tech being undefeated.
Right. Yeah, this is just, I'm surprised to hear they're eight for sure. This is weird because they're all pretty much major schools.
They're all legitimate. Like, you don't.
They're all legit, and there's a chance for six of the seven to go undefeated. I'm not, in no way will that happen, but just the fact that that permutation still exists is remarkable.
All right, let's move on. We're going to talk about the men's basketball team. They open up their exhibition season tonight at 7 against the prestigious St. Leo University. Sort of a different team this year. They lost Nick Calathis and Walter Hodge, scored like a third of their points last year. They're adding Vernon Macklin, big center, freshman guard Kenny Boynton. It's just sort of a new team, as you'll be able to read in the Alligator come about 2 weeks from now. You'll be able to read why exactly this team is different. I'm covering the team this year. I'm not one to argue that different necessarily means better, but I think in virtually every way they'll be different, just because they have to be, not only in personnel, but sort of in attitude as well.
What do you think the starting lineup's going to look like today?
That's a good question. I think you're looking at Irving Walker at the point guard. That's no question. Billy Donovan loves Irving Walker. He's like his guy. I think you'll see Kenny Boynton at shooting guard. I'm going to skip the small forward position. We'll come back to that. Power forward Alex Tice is going to move over from center, and center will be Vernon Macklin. Small forward, he's going to start Dan Werner. He should start Chandler Parsons. Chandler Parsons allows you to do a lot more things. He's more versatile. Dan Werner is a senior, though, and you kind of have to start him.
He's the best defender on the team.
Right? Oh, yeah. According to all his coaches and teammates, he's the best defender on the team.
He's gritty.
Yeah, he just tries so hard.
His intangibles are just going through
the roof. That's the funny thing from talking to him. I didn't think that he would actually talk like this, but he says, like, well, I'm not the most athletic guy, so I just got to go out there and do all the little things and focus on that stuff to be good, which is funny to me because that's the joke we made throughout last season on the podcast.
Yeah, talk about how, you know, also this is different as far as not only the new guys coming in, but then for the guys who are staying, how things are going to be easier on them, so it seems.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Tyus going to start at power forward. That's because Vernon Macklin, who had to sit out last year due to transfer rules, he can start at center. Tyus, who is a natural power forward, doesn't have to, you know, play horribly out of position at center all year. Doesn't have to play as many minutes. He can slide down to the four. He can, you know, show a little more range, do a little more versatile things, and that means Dan Werner does not have to play the four, which is arguably even better because that means Werner doesn't get stuck against some big SEC post guys later in the season.
My mind is mush right now after listening to that, but I'm going to cut to the chase. We all know how Florida basketball fans are awful and terrible and probably the worst in the world and sporting any team.
Right.
Now,
certainly worse than the Tuskers fans.
With Calathis gone and everything, and with the program being, you know, picked to finish fifth in the SEC East.
Yeah.
Why should people care about this team?
Because it's different. It's different, and I think it's going to be more exciting than before. I think you don't know what to expect out of this year's team no matter what. Like, even if they're bad, like, it's going to be kind of exciting to watch in almost, like, a grotesque way. But, like, it's a legitimate basketball team this year.
Pearl Harbor was different.
Oh, no.
Like, all right.
The way I've talked about it, though, is that this is like a more legitimate basketball team. It's a traditional team. You have a real center. You have, like, you don't have a 5'8 shooting guard anymore. Like, you got a guy who, you know, has played point guard all his life playing point guard. You have an exciting young scorer in Kenny Boynton. I don't know. They're deeper. It's just not going to be so painful to watch this year, as I view it.
Is Kenny Boynton going to live up to the hype? Because I need some athlete on this basketball team. I need some athlete.
No.
Ray.
Ray Shipman. According to Billy Donovan, too offensive-minded last year.
A joke.
Yeah, it's a complete joke. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, I think Kenny Boynton, he's not the savior that he's built up to be. None of these guys are the saviors that they're built up to be. That's just too much hype. That's fans desperate for something. They've built up, it's basically just like they're looking for a light at the end of the tunnel. So when Vernon was on the bench, they're like, hey, this guy's going to be good next year. He'll save our program. And then when Boynton signed, they say the same thing for him. And then even when Rod Tishman, such as it is now, I guess, signed on, they're like, oh, he's going to save the backcourt this year. They're just desperate for anything to come on. I made the joke that had freshman Eric Murphy signed separately, people would have looked at him as a savior instead of the role player that he's going to be.
Yeah. I don't want to step on anything we'll do for a preview podcast too much because we're getting a lot into this. But as far as Vernon Macklin, I think Kenny Boynton actually does have a chance to be like the quote-unquote savior everyone thinks he does. Like, maybe he's actually a real baller. Who knows? Macklin, though, will not be that. No. I think you just need him to play defense, rebound, and block shots. And if he does that, that's great because that allows Tyus to slide over. And then Kenny Cagey gets a little bit more time to develop because I think Kenny Cagey can be a good player. I think he showed signs of it last year. He's very raw. And you don't feel good about Kenny Cagey starting and playing 30 minutes a game, but you feel good about Kenny Cagey coming off the bench for 15 to 20 minutes a game. I do anyway.
The cause for concern with Cagey is that, like, Billy Donovan has talked about how great his players' conditioning is, like, all since practice started, and he's always just praising their conditioning, how everybody looks so great. But then whenever he talks about Cagey, he always kind of limits him with a, well, you know, if he can get back in better shape, or, you know, if he can keep up with what we're doing here. I don't think there's a whole lot of cause to believe in him, but like you said, it doesn't really matter because he can come in for 10 minutes a game and not have to do anything other than be a big body, and I think it works out. But one other thing I wanted to talk about, that you mentioned Tyus. I thought this was interesting. I had a debate with somebody else. Who's the leading scorer on this team?
This year?
Yeah.
Oh, AT, 100%.
I like that because most people want to say Boynton. Foolish people want to say Macklin. That's stupid. Macklin's not going to score more than 8 points a game.
Yeah, 10 points a game. Yeah. He's going to look at.
But I think he's going to get probably 8-10 rebounds a game as well.
Right, and if he blocks 2 shots a game, that's productive. Mm. So I'm sure Billy will tell you that. But you think Tyus also?
I think he averages like 15-16 a game.
Why, didn't he get 13 last year, I want to say?
So yeah, he's 13
and 7.
I don't see why he
can't go 2-3 more points a game. And it just depends, I guess, how much you believe in Boynton. I personally, the way their teams run, if you've watched Florida play with Billy Donovan as the coach, it's not conducive to one guy scoring 20 to 25 points a game.
Exactly.
That's not how the offense works. It's not going to be, let's just watch Boynton dump in points. They're going to move the ball. It's going to be teamwork. And Tyus is going to be best at getting his points in the flow of the offense, but then additionally by rebounding and getting his own points on broken plays. So, yeah. That's why I think that.
The other thing about that, and I think it's something Tyus is going to benefit from, is they can run a little bit more. Because Vernon's a big guy, but he's actually fairly fast. He's fairly quick.
Yeah.
He can run a little bit. Irving, he can run. Nick Calathes, you know, as much as everybody loves him, as good as he was, he's a little slow. He's not a running gunner. So I think it's completely different. Just they can do so much different stuff this year.
All right, so without getting into any more of this, we've given you a taste, but give me a score prediction for tonight against Mighty St. Leo.
Jeez, you caught me off guard. 94 to...
Whoa, 94?
94 to 68.
What? All right, you're so far off here. All right, it's going to be...
It's St. Leo.
The real score is going to be 77 to 35. You think St. Leo's going to score... If St. Leo scores 68 points tonight, Florida has a problem this year, like a real problem they need to address immediately.
Well, I want to look up... Go ahead, freelance for a little while here. I want to look up to what they did last year in their exhibition games, because I feel like it's always... Like,
I mean, they're not... When the 04s used to be here, and obviously they were good, like, NBA players, they would hold these joke teams to, like, 20 points. Like, literally, it'd be, like, 25 points at the end of the game. So I think St. Leo will do slightly better than that. I'll give them 35 points, but there's no way Florida goes for 94 either.
All right, last year in the exhibition games, I'm going to say they were the exhibition games, the first listed games, it was Florida-Toledo. Florida scored 80 points. Toledo scored 58.
Okay, Toledo's a MAC team at least. St. Leo?
Florida played Bradley and went 81-58.
Bradley's a team. They're a Valley team.
All right, here we go. This is more realistic.
Give me a joke. I need a real joke.
Southern Utah.
No.
What? No, you're not finding the
exhibition.
You're not
joking. Games yeah, yeah. Those Damn. Are real games, dude. I need, like...
Let me use the intro.
I need, like, Northwood and, you know, those, like, crazy beginning... Lynn College. And so, you know, those are the games we're trying to get.
I'm not seeing Lynn in here. The closest
one. The Braves, they were a tournament team, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah, you flailed.
I don't know, man. I'm looking at the schedule.
I mean, Toledo's not a good team, but at least they're, like, a D1, like...
Southern Utah scored 50 points against them last year.
Southern Utah is a D1 school.
Southern Utah knows how to dribble.
What do you expect out of St. Leo tonight, then?
Okay, Warner.
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 108-49.
Okay.
Rollins. Ooh, Rollins College. 82-53.
Wow.
53.
Yeah. Okay, so that's fine. But that's still, they came in around 50. And I'm going to say they're better on defense this year, I hope. So.
Yeah, but I mean...
It's 68? It's almost 70.
I'll take it down to 58.
Or you can make the argument if it's like a 94-68 game.
They're just running
and gunning. There's points everywhere. It's like Phoenix Suns basketball in the O'Connell Center, which could be exciting to watch.
So. I'll say they scored
80-48.
80-48? Mm-hmm. I mean, they scored 81 both, you know, the first two games last year, their first actual game. So I'd say put them around the 80-point range.
77-35. Just write it in now. It's going to happen.
Just go ahead and pencil that out. I'll just go ahead and write that in my story, actually.
Go ahead. Yeah. Send it in your gamer. We'll change it if we need to. We all know we won't, so it'll be fine.
All right. Well, let's move on then. All right, around the show up, we're going to do our Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. We'll start off with our Reggies. Kyle, you want to start this off?
Well, this weekend I had the opportunity to go to a great, great football game between two incredibly good teams. It was entertaining to watch, a high level of play on the field. And I'm, of course, talking about the Florida-Las Vegas game Friday night in Tropicana Field. The UFL, fledgling UFL league, our Florida Tuskers versus the Las Vegas Locomotives.
Yeah, those locos.
Adam, Defer, and Defer's girlfriend and another one of our friends all made the trip out to Tampa. And we just had the greatest experience ever, so I'm just going to give it to the UFL in general and Tropicana Field for hosting this, although we'll get in that later.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Trop later.
At first, we start off, we go to the window to buy our tickets, and as we're in line to purchase our $20 tickets, two girls approached us and asked us if we needed tickets, and they had six free tickets that we could just have. We were like, oh, okay, great. we took them, of course, walked in. Went inside, bought our Tuskers gear, went, sat down. The seats were great. We were real close, obviously. There weren't a whole lot of people in attendance.
Certainly not a whole lot of loud people in attendance. No, not a lot of fans.
At one point, we filled out a survey to get a free soda, which was awesome. So I was already up like $25 for the night just on the ticket and the soda.
You're playing with house money at that point. Exactly. You got to buy Tuskers gear.
We were riding high. Yeah. And the game ended up being really good. It was a close 27-24 win, in which our Florida Tuskers punched their ticket to the first ever championship game after a 4-0 start. We're hoping for the first undefeated season in league history, and I think they could do it. I think they have what it takes. Brooks Bollinger looks great at quarterback.
No, I think they got it in them, and that's partially because of this guy who I'm going to give my Reggie to, Marcus Maxwell, a receiver for the Tuskers. All right, listen, we missed Gessner out there. Chaz Gessner. He got hurt. The receiving situation was up in the air. My boy Tay Biddle, electrifying playmaker Tay Biddle. He's much like Percy Harvin in that regard. He wasn't quite himself. He had some good plays, but we needed Maxwell to step up. He scored two touchdowns,
great.
And did what I don't. It's more like the Tropicana trip. It's not like the Lambeau leap. He walked over to the stands, the low fence, sat on the fence, and leaned back into the whatever fans were there, I guess.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. It's good to be among the people. Obviously, they're all about the fans. They're all about you, but really, they're all about the fans as well. So I'm going to give it to my boy Marcus Maxwell. McCullough, do something not fun and not about the Tuskers.
I'm going to stick on the same level of talent as the Tuskers. We're going Alabama 2A high school football, Bessemer Academy versus Academy. You want to hear about a way to win a game, this is it right here. This game only went one quarter, not even a full quarter, because after Bessemer's second touchdown, their kicker came out to kick the extra point. No nets behind the field goal, of course. There's a power transformer about 30 feet off the ground. He hits it, blows power to like the surrounding like mile everywhere. So the stadium's lost power. All the traffic lights have lost power. The neighborhood's nearby done. They had to call the game. They win 14-0.
Wow.
Great move by that kicker. Apparently he did it. It's kind of Kyle-ish, though, for the school.
Yeah.
Or Reggie-ish, depending on how it's kind of shystery that earlier in the year, same thing happened in warm-ups, and a game was delayed for a couple hours.
Oh, he knew.
And they didn't fix it, yeah.
Only in the South could this happen, by the way.
Yeah, because they don't play football up north.
No, it's just it would have been fixed, and you would have continued the game, whereas in the South, you blow it out, and the town shuts down. Nobody can do anything. They come with their lanterns and try to fix it, and they can't get it done in time.
You've been to Birmingham, right? That's where this was. This is not like
this
a...
This was in Birmingham?
Town. Yeah.
I'm sticking to it. I'm wrong, but I'm sticking to it.
All right, Kyle, go ahead and give out your Kyle. We'll end on a bad note.
My Kyle Jackson goes to, it hurts me to do this.
No,
really
yeah,
does.
Yeah.
The once great Todd Sauerbrunn, he's now a punter for the Florida Tuskers. He used to be a Pro Bowl punter for the Carolina Panthers in the NFL. A Pro Bowl punter. He was athletic. He had boomed 65 yards on the reg, which ties into something we're about to get into. But he was so pathetic. It was unbelievable. It looks like he put on a ton of weight.
Oh, no.
He kind of he waddles out. He kicks it 25 yards off the side of his foot and then takes off his helmet and waddles back to the sideline where he does some punting drills or whatever. I don't know. It was really just – it was pathetic to watch. At one point, I screamed out.
I was about to say that.
He used to be a Pro Bowler. And it was horrible.
The thing
I felt
is
bad.
That when you say you scream that out, like, it's not like in a Florida game where a fan screams out, like, I love you, Tim Tebow, and, like, nobody hears it, and everybody just kind of laughs in their own section. The entire Trop could hear that, because we were, without a doubt, the loudest people in attendance
I think Todd got the message. I think he heard me.
Oh, I think he did.
And it cut him deep.
Yeah, because his last punt, he boomed that one. It wasn't like his previous shanks.
God, it was so miserable. But anyway, Defer made a great comparison. He compared him to Kenny Powers from the show Eastbound and Down. I don't know if you guys have seen that show. It's really funny. It's about a former minor league pitcher or major league pitcher who's toiling, trying to get back, and it's totally Todd Sauerbrunn.
Yeah, I agree. Todd Sauerbrunn, he needs to get back on track for the UFL championship game. Yeah. If we're going to take down the Redwoods or the Sentinels, we need him to be on
maybe
top of
this game.
Maybe
they'll sign Chaz Henry next year.
Oh,
or
man.
2 years from now, I mean.
That'd be a great pickup for
absolutely.
Him.
Absolutely. Huge pickup.
He's got an NFL leg, though. He's got more than a UFL
Graham
leg.
Graham Gano was the other kicker,
that's
though,
right.
For Las Vegas.
That's right. Former FSU kicker slash punter, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give my Kyle in direct contracts to Kyle's Reggie to Tropicana Field. As good as the environment, you know, not the environment, as good as the venue was itself, I thought that was all good. They didn't actually treat it like it was a Tuskers game. You know, if I'm going to go out there and go all out for the Tuskers, I expect the venue in which they play to do the same. It said, like, welcome Rays fans outside. Like, everything was like, catch some Rays. It was all about the Rays. They didn't change, like, the souvenir cups they gave out. I got World Series cups, which I got when I went to the World Series anyway. I don't know. That was kind of a disaster.
Well,
and
if you want to be able to watch Tuskers football, you're going to have to accept that they can't spend money on anything other than just making sure the players make it to the stadium.
Look, all I'm asking is that when I go get my Dippin' Dots, the souvenir helmet is not that of a Rays batting helmet. It should be a Tuskers football helmet. Is that too much to ask?
See, that's Kyle worthy.
Even the Sounders make Quest Field their own.
Yeah, exactly.
It'd be nice.
Exactly. The Tuskers did not make Tropicana Field their own. No. So I'm going to give Tropicana Field my Kyle. Also for the outrageously expensive food.
Yeah, that's to be expected.
That's just stadium food, but it's like, it's lower the price for the Tuskers game. Come on.
The thing that sucked the worst, I felt like we were the only people who had ever been to a real football game before.
I'd argue we were, yeah.
Like, we were the only ones like making noise, being loud, got some dirty looks.
All right, well, my Kyle Jackson hurts as well to give. It's also given to a once great player. And I think this is unprecedented. My Kyle Jackson bad angle of the week goes to Reggie Nelson.
Ooh.
Oh,
whoa.
He might be the worst starting safety in the NFL.
Oh, no.
Reggie Nelson.
You don't watch Dolphins games.
We need to now. We're going to have to distinguish now that the Reggie Nelson Award for Excellence in the Field of Sport is stopped only with his college career.
Yeah.
His pro career should have absolutely no bearing whatsoever on this award. Because if it did, then it means nothing to get the Reggie Nelson Award.
Yeah.
Reggie has been awful this year. He got trashed by the Seahawks. Vince Young owes him his career. And as Kyle said last night, maybe his life, considering his psychological issues.
He's on
Reggie Nelson
ice.
Got burned over and over and over again yesterday. Granted, it's because Rasheen Mathis was hurt and he had to play corner instead of safety.
Yeah.
But he plays corner a lot anyway when they go into nickel packages. But more concerning to me than his cover skills are his tackling skills. Because that's what Reggie Nelson was kind of known for. He can cover the whole field, never misses a tackle. You know, lays out the big hits. You should go on YouTube and look up Reggie Nelson tries to play football against Tennessee. It's from last year's Titans game. And they have some clowny music in the background. You watch him miss all his tackles. This week, he got trashed by Chris Johnson like four times. Now, Chris Johnson's the man.
He was trashing everyone, yeah.
Now, one of Chris Johnson's long touchdown runs, Reggie Nelson.
Oh, no. Was
had,
that him?
Yeah. Didn't make a bad angle, just whiffed. Totally missed Chris Johnson. Had him dead to rights and did not touch him.
That's not what I was thinking of. Because on one of Chris Johnson's runs, he straight up plowed over somebody and ran 70 more yards.
I mean, that could have been him, too. I know for sure that he just totally missed a tackle. But if you watch that game, other than seeing how bad Reggie Nelson is now, you also saw the battle between Maurice Jones-Drew and Chris Johnson, which was incredible. Yeah. Those guys were breaking long runs like crazy. And on Mo Drew's second touchdown run, I think, he went like 70 yards. Who threw the last block for him at the 5-yard line? David Garrard. That was awesome. I love David Garrard. I mean, he may not be a good quarterback, but he puts forth some effort. He breaks some incredible tackles and makes some good blocks.
All right, well, that wraps it up for today's show. Check back with us, I guess, Friday. We'll preview the Vanderbilt game, probably talk a little bit about how right I was saying 94-68 would be the score of the basketball game tonight.
You mean 77-35?
Nope.
Yes.
Nope.
That's
what you mean. 80-48. All right. Check back with us Friday. Send any feedback to podcast@alligator.org, right on our Facebook wall, facebook.com/alligatorpodcast. Thanks for listening.
End the show, Barry!